This is the Coast 89.7 Weekly News Magazine, Dialogue, highlighting local news stories and events in our Cape Breton communities.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. I'm Dave Wilson. This week, Cape Breton's Hospice Palliative Care Society is embarking on a major fundraising effort, cleaning up our communities. We'll speak with a representative of the Regional Solid Waste Department. And on The Good Sentence with Paul McDougall, Gaelic speaker, teacher, and storyteller Hector McNeil. That's all coming up on Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. The Cape Breton Hospice Palliative Care Society has some ambitious plans for the future and has embarked on a major fundraising campaign. Dialogue spoke with co-chair Patricia Jackson and the head of the build team, Nancy Dingwall.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the formation of the Hospice Care Society and a little bit about its roots?
Well, it's interesting you say roots, because we make a presentation often that we talk about roots, reality, and reaching out. And yes, where we came from was 33 years ago, actually, a group of people met to look at the needs for palliative care services in our community. And the beginning was really supporting the home support program for patients who were at home who needed additional help. And the home program was the beginning of the palliative care movement in Cape Breton. 11 years ago, the society, with the support of the community, was able to donate $1 million to refurbish one of the units at the regional hospital, which is the palliative care unit, Ancala. The word Ancala means the harbour in Gaelic, which is a lovely name for it, because a harbour, as you know, is a place of refuge and a place of safety. And so for 11 years now, the Ancala unit has been open, providing the most incredible care and support to end-of-life patients and their families. As we're moving forward to reality, and I'll let Nancy talk about that.
Well, the reality of what we continue to do today is provide those comfort and care items to patients and their family, and we provide that support on the Ancala unit as well as in patients' homes and the outlying hospitals as well. And the palliative care patients are not just in the unit. They're scattered throughout the hospitals in the area, so the society supports them wherever they are.
And actually, I was doing a little bit of research before you guys came in, you do a lot of hospice care in the community as well. It's not just at the Ancala unit at the hospital.
The service provides home support, and I think there are 5 home consult nurses. So if they identify a need in the home that the society can help with, then they'll bring it to us, and we hopefully are able to put into place what they need for those patients so that they can stay at home. Everybody would like to die at home, and if we can help that happen, then we're happy to support the service and the patients and families to make that happen.
And this brings us to a next question. Just to sort of clarify, if you could explain what palliative home care is.
Well, palliative home care is the palliative care service and the team of the service, the doctor, the physician, maybe social worker if it's needed, and they will access support from VON and home care and other services in the community that make it possible for patients to remain in their own home. As Nancy said, what we as an organization do is to support the service in some of the extra needs that aren't able to be provided through the medical team and able to people to stay at home. Sometimes it's as simple in the wintertime, particularly as the house is not warm enough and they have inadequate oil, we're able to provide a tank of oil. There are many small little things that are extremely important at the time, but are relatively small, but they make such a difference and such an impact on patients and their families.
And there was another thing I noticed, and that was the music therapy program. And of course, we being a radio station, we very much like music. Maybe you could tell us a little bit more about how the music therapy program works.
Well, I'll start and then Patricia can join in. I mean, we are very, very fortunate to have talented music therapist Jill work with us, and the society funds her position, and she works with patients in the hospital and in their homes. And what she does for patients is truly amazing. Music therapy can help alleviate pain, but she also works with the families, and she's done some incredible legacy projects that the patients have been able to do CDs with meaningful songs, whether they're picked off the Coast radio or whether they sing them themselves, and make a CD personalized to each family member. She also has a Build-A-Bear program where she will record patients' voices with messages for loved ones, and they can leave that with their family members. And there was one gentleman who had two daughters. He died in the service, and he was the first, actually, I think, to build a bear and leave his voice message for his young teenage daughters. And what she does is incredible.
And, of course, we're talking about Jill Murphy, who is the music therapy person,
yes,
for Hospice Cape Breton. So let's talk a little bit more about the volunteers that work at the with your society.
The volunteers are quite an extraordinary, dedicated group of ladies and gentlemen, who many of them have been working with palliative care now for 15, 20 years. They work in the hospital on the palliative care unit. They provide marvelous baking, cookies, tea biscuits. They support patients when they can, sitting with them if it's necessary, and they're requested to. They support the families in the kitchen with laughter and tears. They're just there to help whenever they're needed, at whatever they're needed. They help to create a home-like environment on the unit. There are a few volunteers who work in the home. It is part of the program that we need to redevelop a little bit. But they too provide support as and when needed. Again, this is provided at the request of the service. They identify the needs and access the volunteers based on what the service sees the needs. We provide all of the education and all of this ongoing support. We had a volunteer appreciation day last week, which was very well received. They have education at it and appreciation, and really, you can't say enough good things about what the volunteers do.
So now let's move on, because there's a couple of fundraisers coming up. And the first one I want to ask you about, on May 5th, you're going to be holding a pop-up shop. So you could tell us a little bit about the pop-up shop.
We are, and this is the fourth year for the pop-up shop. And what we do is we ask the community to donate things that they no longer have any need for, or things that they think someone else will enjoy and appreciate. And our first drop-off session was last weekend. We have another one coming up the last weekend in April. So far, the donations have been incredible. And it's set up to resemble a department store. And people are invited to come in and check out the treasures and hopefully purchase some of them.
So the donations, the next drop-off day is end of April.
I know the 27th, so it's the Thursday, Friday, Saturday, the last Thursday, Friday, Saturday in April.
Okay.
And the sale is the 3rd, 4th, and 5th of May.
Okay. So it's on the 3rd, 4th, and 5th of May. And where will the shop be popping up?
The shop is at 291 Esplanade, which is directly across from the Holiday Inn. It's the lower level of Oak Hall. And the owners of Oak Hall have been incredibly generous in giving us the space for 4 years in a row.
Excellent. Now, the other one I want to ask you about, because is Shake, Rattle, and Roll. Maybe you could tell us a little bit more about Shake, Rattle, and Roll.
Shake, Rattle, and Roll is our 50-60s dance, and it's been going on for several years now. The date for that is April 27th at Center 200. Tickets are $60 a person. It's an evening of incredible music, local musicians. The Stars on 45 is what they're calling themselves this year, but Stephen Muse, Jen Shepherd, and their friends, who most people know, are incredible, and they provide an incredible show. And people dance all night long, and again, we invite the public to come and have a fun-filled evening.
My last question, I kind of want to ask about the future of Hospice Cape Breton.
We are very excited about the possibility of a 10-bed hospice being a reality in the very near future. This is something that we have planned for a very long time. And I know everybody's saying that we've been talking about this for a long time, which we have, but we truly believe that this will be a reality in the immediate future. It will be a purpose-built 10-bed hospice, which will be situated. Member 2 has donated the land. It's close to the regional hospital. If you know where the daycare is, just below that, it's a beautiful site. It overlooks Rotary Park. And the design of the building has been ready for quite some time now, with a great deal of thought given by both the staff and by architects and designers. And we're really excited about it. And I do truly believe this will be a reality in the next very short while.
Picking up the trash, keeping things clean in Cape Breton Regional Municipality is an ongoing effort. Recently, Dialogue's Donnie Antle spoke with CBRM Solid Waste Department Education Coordinator, Rochelle Clark.
How many years has the cleanup day been held?
It's been taking place since 2016, so approximately this will be our fourth year holding this event.
In the past, what has the community involvement been like?
It's been really, really good. We've had thousands of people come out and volunteer, and I think roughly to date there's been a little over 16,000 bags of litter removed over the course of one day for those 4 years.
And so are we expecting turnout to be much the same this year?
I'm hoping the turnout will be just as great, if not better, this year. Hopefully the weather will cooperate. It'll be a nice day, and people can get geared up to visit one of the local fire departments in their area or fire hall where the cleanup will meeting points will be, and come out, get some bags, gloves, and then get busy removing the litter from ditches in our street. We want everybody to get involved, whether you're an individual or your family wants to get involved, or you're part of a group, or you're working for a business or an organization. Come out and participate.
And how can people register to take part in the day?
They can visit the CBRM website, and there will be a link right on the website that will take them to the registration page where you can register and sign up.
Now, is there a deadline for registration?
You can register right up till, I believe, the day before the actual cleanup, or you can actually show up on the day of the cleanup as well. To register, however, you will have a chance to win a prize if you register early.
And what would the prize be?
I believe it's a chance to win a barbecue.
On May 4th, 9 a.m., the people arrive. Where do they go?
Well, it depends on where you live. You would register online, and then that'll tell you where in your community you would go. For example, if you're from the north side in North Sydney, you would go to the North Sydney Fire Station. Sydney Mines, you would go to the Sydney Mines Fire Station. Glace Bay, you would also go to the Glace Bay Fire Station. But again, check online to see where your designated meeting point is for your community. It will tell you when you register online.
And what sort of supplies will be given to the volunteers before they head out to fight the battle against the litter?
They're going to be provided gloves and bags. And, of course, there'll be hand sanitizer on site for when you come back to just wash your hands properly.
Let's talk a little bit about Heavy Garbage Day. When are the Heavy Garbage Day pickups?
The date for Heavy Garbage this year is Monday, April 29th, and we would ask that all homeowners or residents have their materials out to the curb on or before 6 o'clock in the morning, because we don't know where the collectors are going to be starting in the areas. So we want everyone across the municipality to have their materials to the curb, ready for pickup on April 29th, before or on by 6 a.m.
And, of course, as I drive around, and I'm sure everybody else has noticed this as well, there actually are people that are putting out their heavy garbage right now.
Right. People have started to put their materials out curbside. We do ask that when you do place your materials out for collection, that you do place it to the curb. Try to avoid placing your materials on sidewalks or in areas where you're going to interfere with pedestrian traffic. We don't want people who are going out for walks to have to take detours to go around your piles, which the detour could be out into the streets. So do not block the sidewalks with your materials. We encourage residents to maybe place their materials out curbside the weekend leading up to April 29th if they're able to do so. We also want to make sure that people don't put incorrect materials in their piles. And what I mean by incorrect materials is there are materials that we will not be collecting, such as tires. We don't want tires in your piles. Any electronics that fall under the electronic recycling program, such as computers and TVs, they're popular items to place out, but they are not accepted to join this collection. Propane tanks and the small propane tanks, please avoid putting those materials out to the curb as well. And we also encourage residents, if they have questions about heavy garbage, to phone our hotline at 902-567-1337 or visit our website, because there is a good deal of information located on the website about heavy garbage collection as well.
Time now for The Good Sentence with Paul McDougall. Today, Paul speaks with Gaelic speaker, teacher, and distinguished storyteller at the upcoming Isle of Story Festival, Hector McNeil.
I was born and raised in Portage, East Bay. My father came from Castle Bay, and Gaelic was the first language for him. There were lots of people in Portage who spoke Gaelic as well, although they were not necessarily from that community. Maybe they moved in from McAdams Lake or from Castle Bay, like my father did, or neighbors did as well. So there was Gaelic around, and you were hearing it. But Castle Bay was kind of a place where we go in the summertime. We'd go help make the hay, and these kind of, as we grew older, we could be more useful around the place, spend more time there. And, of course, in Castle Bay, that's where our people came from, when they came from Barra.
And Castle Bay is close to Christmas Island, right?
Yeah, it is. It's just past Escasoni and then maybe 10 miles from 10 miles east of Christmas Island from mm-hmm. there. Yeah, yeah. And settled by Barra people in the early 1800s. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there were a lot of people there speaking Gaelic, and you'd hear it, and you'd hear them telling the stories, but of course they tell them in Gaelic, and they might translate for you, but most times not. It's just not funny in English and that kind. But it piqued your interest in it, you know. But culturally, it was a really interesting place, you know. You come through Escasoni, which was a different place, of course, you know, Mi'kmaq community, and then you'd come and you'd see Tossil's store to the right on the hill, and you knew then that you were in Castle Bay. And it was like going to another country in a way, you know, although Portage was country, but this was beyond that, you know. And it was as a child, it was kind of a magical place, you know, with cows and horses and sheep and all that great stuff that you love, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this is your early days as a kid.
Yeah.
And spending summers there, but not really understanding the language, maybe a word or two at the most, I would say, right?
That's right. That's yeah. right. And I guess like a lot of people I talked to from Cape Breton, I wanted to learn the language, but it was inaccessible. There weren't the classes you're looking for. I remember going into the bookstore on McLeod's bookstore on Charlotte Street, and I bought the book Gaelic Made Easy.
Oh, yes. Yeah. And was it?
No, it definitely was not. You know, and I looked at it, and if I would have had enough sense to sit down with my father and ask him about it, you know, but I was kind of a teenager, kind of independent, and I wanted to kind of learn it. And so, you know, you see T-H-A and M-I, you know, ha, me, I know now, but I didn't know. It was impenetrable for me at the time, you know. But I think there's a lot of people of our generation, my generation, maybe our generation, who wanted to learn at one point or another, or would love to be able to speak it. But eventually I got the opportunity. I went back to, I started university. I was in my later 20s and started university. I took a Gaelic course at St. Evex with Sister Margaret MacDonnell and a course in Irish mythology and literature with Maureen Lonergan, she was at the time, Maureen Williams now. And then I was hooked, you know. I really saw someplace where I belonged there and wanted to pursue it.
So you would work for a number of years sort of as a laborer in that in your 20s, right?
Yeah.
And then you go back to university.
Yeah.
And and then decide along the way, you're studying Celtic studies, right?
Yes, yes.
So, and then it's language class. So is there a point where you say in your head, I'm going to learn this language, I'm going to get fluent, I'm going to master it, or did it sort of, as you went along, evolve that you somehow realized, I'm actually starting to learn this and understand this? How did that process go?
That's interesting. There was a pivotal point there, and it's a very simple thing. But before we get there, you started in the classes, and you're writing, you know, you're learning how to say, I am good, I am well in Gaelic and that. But then I was in class with Sister MacDonnell. She was an excellent teacher. I learned more in her class in the first year than I've ever been able to teach to students in the first year, you know. At one point, she said... I remember she said, Haku Wakum. That means I have a dog, Haku Wakum. And I had a dog, and he was my best buddy, you know. Haku Wakum, that's real. I can say that. If I can say that, I can say other things. And if I say enough of those things, I'll be speaking this language. and really, that was the point. I said, yes, I can learn this. You know, I don't have to be able to. I mean, you do in the university, you have to be able to analyze the language. And I actually enjoy that kind of stuff. But you don't have to do that to analyze the language to be able to speak it. You just have to be able to say what it is you want to say. And that was the point early on. And I thought, and there was a lot of hard work after that. I worked hard at it. It's not easy to learn any language. And Gaelic isn't an easy language to learn. But it's a lot of work after that. But that was a pivotal moment, really.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Haku Akam.
That's right.
Haku. Yeah. So you're learning this, and you have your haku moment,
yes.
as we can call it.
Could write a poem about
that's
that.
That's right. Yes. That's right. Yes, we leave that for our listeners, too.
Yes.
A Haku Akam poem. Okay. You ended up... Basically, you made a career from the Gaelic language. You've been involved with the Gaelic College in St. Anne's for years. You taught at CBU many years courses. You've been involved with the Christmas Island Fesh for like 20-some years. All of these things. Hmm. Again, did you sort of fall into that? Or when you were studying, were you thinking, oh, maybe someday I'll be a good enough Gaelic speaker that I can teach people? How did that happen?
Well, yeah, I guess the simplest answer is that at one point I thought that I'm learning this language, and at that time there was maybe three people I knew in Cape Breton of my age who were becoming or were fluent in the language or becoming fluent, maybe four, and I thought, if I'm going to have anyone to speak to, when I actually become fluent, I'm going to need to teach people this language, and we need to address this. And I was conscious early on before that in our family, my father, you know, my father's people came from Barra. My mother's people on one side came from Barra as well. They're Campbells. Neither I nor my siblings spoke the language. And my father was the only one who had children, his brother, his sister, and he was the only one who had children. And I realized that the language is going to die with this generation. It had been spoken by our people for 1,000 years, how long, I don't know. And it was important to uphold it. You can't always do that, uphold old things, but sometimes you can. I realized, one, that I would need to teach people to language or help to teach them. And two, it was important personally that it continue in our family, that lineage. And it was important that Gaelic have an environment where it can where it could prosper, something to nourish it. Early on, and I don't mean to throw a negative into this, but when I was learning, and even when I was starting to look for employment in Gaelic, and there was an attitude that it was fairly prevalent, I'm afraid, that Cape Breton Gaelic, and we'll say Nova Scotia Gaelic, I always refer to Cape Breton because that's my area, but Cape Breton Gaelic was somehow inferior to, Scottish Gaelic, the Gaelic in Scotland, and the Gaelic in the cultural sense, in its widest sense, was somehow a poor cousin. And there were a couple of people around, Jim Watson from at the Highland Village, for one, and through him, and also from John Shaw as well, who were saying, look at the wealth of oral material we have in Cape Breton here. Look at these. Look at the stories. Look at these songs. This is amazing stuff what we have here. And thank God they were there, because there may have been people there. I'm sure there were people who appreciated what Gaelic held for everyone, but they were saying it, and they were saying it loudly, loudly, but they were saying it so you could hear it, and that was really important.
As a storyteller, because next week you're actually being honored by the Isle of Story Festival, which is a joint venture of the Cape Breton Regional Library and the Beaton Institute and other groups, this is a festival that's been... It's in its third year now, and you're their distinguished storyteller. So you can't escape it now. That you're beyond just a storyteller. You're a distinguished storyteller now. So just what does, which is a great honor, and congratulations on that.
Thank you very much. It is a great honor indeed, yeah. And I'm humbled by that honor.
Yeah. So that'll be the 24th, actually, for our listeners. Your event, where you're going to be speaking on Gaelic and storytelling and that at the McConnell, right?
Yes.
McConnell. That's an afternoon event, which can all be found on the easiest way is go to the library website, and you can find this many other events happening. We'll get to that later. But what does the storyteller mean, or what is the role of the storyteller, and in particular in your situation, the Gaelic storyteller?
Well, in traditional Gaelic culture, the office of storyteller was a very important office, and I don't pretend to rise to that level at all. The storyteller was so important. I mean, the Gaelic in general has the largest store of vernacular literature of any culture, any people in Western Europe. And this is all being brought down, handed down through the manuscript tradition and through the oral tradition, and some say an interplay between the manuscript tradition and the oral tradition, to continue these stories over 1,500 years, 1,400 years. What is it? The stories of Fionn MacCool in Ireland, a band of hunter warriors. In Ireland sometime around the 7th century. Those stories are told in Cape Breton. They're still told a generation ago, two generations ago, and there are a few people now in Cape Breton who can tell some of those stories again. That's immensely important that we continue that kind of knowledge of where we come from. And then there's other cycles of stories, like the stories of the clans, and there's the historical stories. There's stories of the supernatural. There's a whole belief system that's kind of interwoven with regular beliefs, beliefs such as a second sight, and that's found all over the world, and you'll certainly find those stories in Cape Breton. These stories, when I was doing that course at St. Yvette's with Maureen Williams, and it was Irish mythology, we were doing the mythological cycle at the time, and there were these characters in the stories. In Irish, like in Gaelic, the gods and the mythology, they're not perfect. They're flawed, you know. Some of them are real jerks, you know. But they're part of a wider scheme. And there were people or figures in this mythological cycle. I said, oh, that's just like so-and-so, you know. And it was, you know, how many hundreds of years, like 1,000 years at least, that personality comes through to translate into a personality I knew in my community growing up.
These are people you recognize in like Castle Bay or Iona or whatever.
Yeah, Portage. Right. He's just like that fellow, you know.
Right.
And there's a beautiful continuity there. And it's just for that, it's so important that we continue that because it's there for us. Why not drink from that glass?
Mm-hmm. You've said, this is a line that you've said in another talk at one time, there's an innate tendency to hold on to the traditions brought to the new world and a heightened identification with the old country that seems to defy the passage of time. Like, how is that? What is this continuity?
Well, when you when people will leave... When I was teaching classes, Gaelic classes, I'd have someone say who was from, had gone away to the Boston States, we'll say, and they're away for 30 years, 40 years. They'd come back and they'd have stories, they'd have memories that were so clear, so vivid, so detailed, they could tell you, you know. They would forget the Gaelic, maybe they forget words in the Gaelic, and it would take them a little while to get that back. But their memories of being in Cape Breton, growing up where they grew up, were so clear because they hung on to those memories. They rehearsed those memories, and, you know, when they were in Boston, where they were, this wasn't just, oh, I never thought about this in years. They have thought about that. And people, when they leave a country, when they left Scotland and came here, and they settled in areas where other people like them settled, like people in Barra tended to settle with other people from Barra. And they continued that their tradition. They continued the song tradition, the storytelling, the language, the music, the dance. But it had, I believe, a heightened importance because it was so, because they were separated from Barra, because they were separated from their place of origin, whether it be Lewis or Skye, wherever it might be, that they just, it became far more precious even to them than it was before, because it was very tenuous now.
So, adding on to that then, and think about it as a storyteller yourself, or people from other traditions, the Mi'kmaq, Cadian, French, whatever, are when we think of the stories and you go to a session with the storyteller and he or she is telling a story to an audience or trying to get something from the audience to tell you, can you, nowadays in the modern concept, can you make up a story and then so... That it's totally new, but it has maybe a feel of the old, and then so that maybe 30 years from now, some student of yours will be telling the story Hector told, but maybe the first time you told it was the first time. Is this part of storytelling tradition, like making up a new story?
I think it's part of an oral tradition to draw in new elements from other cultures, other influences, whether you're talking 500 AD or, 2019. I think that's part of the process. We try to I can only speak for Gaelic story tradition. One tries to remain as faithful to the original story and even the phrasing, the wording in the story as you can. But we're humans, and things, other things come in. People make a little change in the story, make a little alteration, they change the phrasing, and they tell that story and someone else. So a story is an organic thing. It's not like we take a story, we write it down, we put it in a book, and that's how it is, you know. You know, it was a beautiful day. But when it's an oral tradition, yes, people try to do that. And in cultures and oral cultures, they do that word by word by word. But we're not in that culture now. So changes come in. Changes have been coming in for 1,500 years. And I wouldn't mind composing a story and telling that story in Gaelic, of course. But I'd say this is a story I composed, mm-hmm. you know. And I hear stories, humorous stories, and I forgot to say before, there are a lot of humorous stories, wonderful humorous stories in Gaelic. And I'll hear a story in Gaelic from an older person, an older speaker, and I wonder where that came from originally, you know. Yeah. Because, I mean, this is the golden age of the joke right now, you know. You know, it's some of them sound like kind of a longer form of a joke, a setup, a punchline. They can come from anywhere.
I think when a lot of people think of Gaelic stories now, whether you have a Gaelic or Scottish or Irish background or not, it wouldn't matter. You think you're sort of anticipating something funny to happen because there's so many of them are.
That's right. That's yeah. right. Yeah. Yeah. And we expect the funny story. We expect it was the entertainment value
yeah.
in a funny story is very high. But not all Gaelic stories are like that.
No, not at all.
Yeah.
But like there's that classic one that I'm always telling people at events where the two old guys are over in Mabu or Judic or somewhere sitting on the steps, and the young guy comes back from St. Evex and he talks about learning Gaelic.
Yes.
Why don't we tell that one?
I'm sorry. You kind of got me.
Okay. Well, that was the one where one of the older guys asked the other guy how he's doing with the studying the Gaelic.
Yes.
At St. Evex.
Yes.
Let's say it was a young you, right? And you said, well, I'm coming along. I can understand it,
yes.
but I can't speak it.
Yes.
And the one guy, what does one guy say to the other guy?
He says, yes, I've got a dog at home just like that.
I mean, you just, it's a short snapper, but it's a good one.
Yeah, right? Well, that's right. Yeah.
Yes.
yeah. Yeah. And that was so typical as people drew away from the language. And as people who went, say, to Boston or Boston States, and they'd be away for even a couple of months. And as people tell me, of course, it's before my time, but or they'd be away for a year or two and they come home and they would have acculturated to the English way. And they couldn't remember a word of Gaelic. You know, they lost all their Gaelic. And that would just rile people, some people. And
yeah.
Perfect times when we say yes, a dog, like that.
Yes, there's some kind of self-deprecating thing about the whole thing, or just like, you know, or trying to bring you back down to where you belong,
well,
or whatever.
That's right. And, you know, it's my experience, and I shouldn't speak in generality so much, but my experience is that, you know, it's more the razor than the hammer, you know, that, you know, like if people aren't going to clobber you with a real, you know, you stupid so-and-so.
Yeah.
They're just going to say something very quiet and very kind of slip it in there. And, you know, maybe 10 minutes later you say, oh, my heavens, you know, I'm bleeding.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so that sort of thing. Much more subtle, yeah.
Now, there's an expression, more razors than hammers, and I've not heard that before.
Well, I just made it up.
Oh, well, there you go.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah, yeah.
That's, you translate that to Gaelic, and you're on to your... I was in the radio station in Glace Bay one day.
That's right. Yeah.
Yes, and we were talking about new stories. So I want to ask you about a person that I know that is very dear to your heart and was very instrumental in helping you become a better Gaelic speaker in a more informal sense, because you speak of her all the time. It's almost as if I know Aunt Jessie.
Oh, for heaven's sake,
yeah. Tell us just a little about you. This is your brother's, your father's sister.
Yeah, my father's sister, young Castle Bay. Jessie Jesse was a big kind of a tall, statuesque woman, strong, lovely woman, a smile like a child, you know. She was born in, her mother died in 1919, Jesse was 13 years old, and she became the woman of the house for her father, her two brothers, Donald and Hector, was my father. And she rose to the challenge, and, you know, she has stories like the first time people came up from Sydney, and they wrote, there was a lovely brook there in Castle Bay on the property. They were fishing trout in the brook, and they brought them back, and everybody was so proud of the big trout, beautiful trout, and my grandfather asked her to cook them, to fry them. She had never fried trout before, you know. Her mother had done all that, and she had to fry the trout for these strangers, and everyone said that it was really good, and they enjoyed them, and she was scared to death. She burned them too much. You know, she came into that as a child. But as a result of that, and I think she had, you know, it wasn't easy for her. It wasn't easy for a lot of people at the time. But she got to spend time with her father's generation. When people were in visiting, she was making the tea. She was serving the tea. She was there in the room. Although she might have been a girl of 13 or 16 or whatever she might have been. So she had a memory that, you know, would go back to the log cabin that they first lived in. I think it was actually the second log cabin. They built a temporary one, but the second log cabin. And a rant talking about, you know, how the cold the dirt floor was. And the time would be Jesse's uncle, cut his toe on the axe. Yeah, lay the axe sticking out behind the stove, and he cut his, you know, she had these stories from that time. The guy who came on a reichach, wanting to marry one of the girls, and she rejected him. And she had this took place in the log cabin, and then the log house after that, you know, which is so warm because it had a wood floor. Mm-hmm. And she could just take you back there, you know.
Right.
These are her stories. They weren't the Finian legends or any of that. It was just commonplace stories, but really interesting.
Yeah.
So, and I'd sit with her and get her to tell these stories over and over. You know, I go there, and even when I left to work in Halifax, I come home on the weekends, and often my first stop would be Castle Bay, spend a night there. And she didn't mind telling you the same story, you know. She'd tell you the same story every night if you wanted to, and she enjoyed it. That was her conversation.
Yeah.
So it was a great cultural orientation for me, and a wonderful personal experience, too.
Yeah, so as I said earlier, we're with Hector McNeil here. He's a renowned Gaelic speaker, teacher, storyteller, and you learned it all really both ways. You used academics to learn, and you learned it from the people, right, that are around you.
That's right.
And
that's
you worked right. at it.
Oh, yes. I worked hard at it, yeah. I went to St. Evex, and I came down to CBU as well. I finished my BA at CBU, and then went back to St. Evex for a master's in Celtic studies, and then I started working and learning, but trying to put it together. I think it still holds true. I used to say this maybe carelessly, but one of the things I loved about Gaelic, the whole Gaelic field, is you have people with PhDs or master's degrees talking to farmers and fishermen and steelworkers, you know, so that they can learn how to speak properly, you know, emulate, not just learn, but not just recording, but emulating them, learning their ways, learning the language and the stories and the whole way of being. It's a wonderful experience like that. You know, it's a holistic experience for someone who really pursues it, you know. The Gaelic speakers are a lot fewer now. The right. older people are fewer now, but there's still people here, and people still enjoy visits. And
how many Gaelic speakers do you think we have now in Lethnic Cape Breton? You got a handle on the number? A few hundred?
Well, the number I read from other people in Gaelic Field these days is 500 to 700 in Nova Scotia. Mm-hmm. And I think the difference there would be in the demographics, that at one time most of the Gaelic speakers would have been first language speakers, native speakers, as they say. And now I think that's flipped, is that there's at least as many learners or people have learned the language as people grew up with the language. And there may be more mm-hmm. people learn the language than people grew up with the language. And that's not, it's unfortunate that the older generation are going on. It's unfortunate in many ways, not just linguistically or culturally. It's just unfortunate to lose these people. But there are young people learning the language, and there's young people raising their children in Gaelic now.
Right.
And that's really encouraging. A lot of encouraging things going on in Cape Breton now.
Yeah. Well, that's terrific. I noticed just earlier this week there was a new memorandum of agreement between the Gaelic College and CBU to work on and focus more collaborative things. So that's interesting. And there's all kinds of Gaelic stuff that goes on around Cape Breton, mm-hmm. as does stuff from many other cultures. And as I said, Hector is the distinguished storyteller at this year's Isle of Story Festival that's going to run 24th to 27th. Again, go to the Cape Breton Regional Library website to learn more about that. Their theme this year is multiculturalism. So Gaelic is a component. Mi'kmaq, there's a couple of sessions on Mi'kmaq. There's an Acadian session. They have a guest they're bringing in from other regions. There's many things. It's everybody's free, and everybody's welcome at the various venues. So I encourage people to get out to see, listen, hear some of this. So since it's a storyteller festival, you've got a session for at the McConnell. I assume you're going to talk a bit about storytelling in general and maybe tell one?
Oh, I'm assuming. Yeah, we're going to have a storytelling circle. And I don't know exactly what they'll ask of me yet, but I'll be ready anyway.
Do you got a a little short one you want to finish off here, our session on the radio? And I'll thank you ahead of time.
Oh, you're very welcome. Yeah, I'm very happy to be here.
Okay.
At one time, as you know, in Cape Breton and many rural areas, people were traveling, you know, they could go up to any house and be welcomed in for a cup of tea and a bite to eat. And if they needed a bed for the night, it was just part of what the way it was. You know, I remember my Aunt Jessie saying once, you'd never lock the door when you left the house. You know, she says, that would be a terrible thing to do. What if somebody came and they needed to get in? You know, that would be awful for them to get to the door and it's locked. So, and also in Gaelic storytelling in general, there is a theme that runs through it at times. Someone using their wits to get through a situation, so anyway, this is a little story, but I guess it takes in both those. Gamish goro ganaum sho vajish down, but there at koshoch but shul at kosh. Vat faski is ach groch is wache hounds. Vat giri acha is fan of hae get beer gus joch is gurch acha san suyuka you. It happens that one time there were these two men, they were traveling in Cape Breton and they were traveling by foot. And it was a warm day and they were tired and they were hungry and they were wanting a place to stop where they could get a bite to eat or even a place to sit down. And what all shechted and tie shot, tie pick snock of ounds. I guess, what fish of a kayak test, tie brie of ounds, horse rich in yadella. Cousin, nach so ye, nach statin showers, as in, cause a fishing grain bee, cup of tea. So they're going by this beautiful little house and by the side of the road, very neat and tidy and lovely little place. And one fellow says to the other, he says, oh, why don't we stop here? He says, this is a lovely little place. I'm sure we'll get a cup of tea. Oh, it's a fella. A ruikules, I says. A gal gandarishin, I says. Hanayu stayer and darishin. Baranach cross darishin. I guess, haliki dunyusin bi ustay. Dunyusin bi. Oh, the other fellow says, no need, he said, going to that door to try to get in. You won't get in that into that house. There's a cross woman that lives there, and she won't let anybody in the house. Oh, I said, well, that's a great thing. If I miss you, I said, you miss you, I said, Oh, he said, I think I'll get in. I'll get in that door. Hanai usa no jia stai arandarish. And I said, komalat. The other fellow said, never mind. He said, neither you nor God will get in that door. Never mind. Yomisha stai. I'll get in, he said. Chaya gandaris. Granka gandaris. Hanikaven chod gas gandaris. Goskal, yeah. He went to the door. He knocked on the door. A lovely woman. She came to the door. She opened it. Chonicky and strange, and Hesu went into the movie shop. He saw this stranger standing outside. Well, I say, And she said, well, you know, good sir. He said, will you tell me, what did I call you? Oh, I said, Kani at room, sir, William Jansuya. Well, he said, they call me William Sit Down. So she, William Jensuya. Well, she thought it was kind of odd. She said, William, sit down. Tapalata says, Smish a niche, and she'd been in Tay Horst, Chayestays Roinasuya. Thank you, he said. I'll do that. It's the woman of the house that said it, invited me in. So he went in and he sat down. But I own a pay of his son and tea. He was in there and he was waiting for his tea.
Excellent. Hector McNeil, Tapalat.
Tapalatia.
And that's our show for today. Thanks for listening. For Dialogue, I'm Dave Wilson.
Catch Dialogue 3 times weekly, Sundays at noon, Tuesday and Thursday at 10 p.m. Dialogue is a production of the Coast 89.7 News. For story suggestions, contact 902-849-9303 or email news@coastalradio.ca. For past episodes of Dialogue, check out our Dialogue podcast, available now online at coastalradio.ca.